Okay, brothers and sisters, Bay Area legend, journalist, historian, father, grandfather, and my personal friend, brother Bill Mandel, just died the other day. He was a legendary KPFA broadcaster. You know, he's one of those that came along when KPFA first started, when nobody got paid. And they built that station up to what it is today. And, you know, he deserves the recognition. There's a lot that could be said about this gentleman, but here I'm going to say this. His name, dig this, Bill Marks Mandel. This is a political family, you have to understand. Like, I named my son Malik after Malcolm X, who changed his name to Alhaj Malik Shabazz. People do that. So Bill's family, William Marks Bill Mandel, was born June 4th, 1917 in New York City as a former American broadcast journalist, left-wing political activist, and author, best known as a Soviet expert. In fact, Bill, I didn't really understand what an expert he was until I read his book. He had me read a book called Soviet But Not Russian. And I said, come on, don't play with words. What is this silly book about? He said, well, why don't you just read it and then judge? I did, and it began a real education in my life to understand more clearly what the Soviet Union was. Also, I have to say, I assumed, because Bill had been a member of the Communist Party, that this was some slavish, pitiful litany of excuses for the bureaucratic abuses of the Soviet oligarchy. In fact, it was a very critical and intelligent document that explained the 112 languages that they speak in the Soviet Union at that time. The whole nature of that society, given the fact that they could not create that society without conquering the national, what's called the national question. I learned a lot reading Bill's book. Bill was a very, very sharp individual. And I'm going to miss him, to be honest with you. But what I would like to do now, if I may, is I'm going to play Bill Mandel standing up to the House of Un-American Activities as a tribute to him. And I hope you guys get something out of this.
On March 24th, 1953, a radio and television audience of millions heard the testimony of William Mandel, author, summoned before the Senate Committee investigating government expenditures. Let's hear this testimony. McCarthy and Munt had directed attention to the Jewish origins of a previous witness. And so, at the outset...
Mr. Mandel, you are reminded that you're still under oath. Counsel.
Mr. Mandel, would you give us your full name, please?
My name is William Marks Mandel, and to save you the trouble of bringing out any possible pseudonym, as you did with the matter of Mr. Auerbach, I'd like to make clear that I am a Jew.
That you are what?
That I am a Jew.
So am I, and I don't see that that's an issue here.
Well, a Jew who works for McCarthy is thought of very ill by most of the Jewish people in the
country. Are you a member of the Communist Party?
My dear sir, I have never consulted with a Communist Party in any manner regarding the writing of the four books
I have written. Mr. Mandel, are you a member of the Communist Party?
I'm going to answer your question, sir, under my privilege and the Constitution, but I'm going to answer it in my own way. This is a book burning. You lack only the tinder to set fire to the books as Hitler did 20 years ago. And I'm going to get that across to the American people.
Are you a member of the Communist Party?
We will have no more of that, Mr. Mandel. You will answer the questions put to you, or the... Where's the officer? Officer? I want you to stand by. We'll have no more of this. Mr. Cohen is our chief counsel. He's entitled to
in normal courtesy, you will answer his questions.
Are you a member of the Communist Party?
I refuse to answer that question under my privilege and the Fifth Amendment not to be a witness against myself.
Have you ever engaged in sabotage against the United States?
I refuse to answer that question under my privilege and the Fifth Amendment not to be a witness against myself.
Fifth Amendment. Do you honestly feel that if you were to tell us truthfully whether you engaged in sabotage against the United States, that might tend to incriminate you?
That might tend to incriminate me, but it is in no sense an admission of guilt, because the purpose of the Fifth Amendment is to protect the innocent, as anybody who knows its history knows.
Have you ever engaged in espionage against the United States?
I refuse to answer under my privilege in the Fifth Amendment not to testify against myself.
Comment by Mr. Mandel.
On December 7th, 1952, the New York Times carried a letter from a trial lawyer, Mr. Harold H. Corbin, which sets forth the legal basis for the use of the amendment. I quote him: "Everyone acquainted with criminal practice knows that many an innocent person has brought about his own indictment by waiving his constitutional privilege and unwittingly supplying some missing link in a chain of circumstantial evidence tending to connect him with the commission of a crime. The pitfalls and dangers of testifying without immunity are so obscure and so manifold that experienced lawyers do not permit a client to thus testify, however certain they may be of his innocence. Lawyers of all men should know and understand the origin and reason for the constitutional privilege, which was to protect innocent witnesses against the inquisitorial and manifestly unjust methods of interrogating witnesses, the temptation of prosecutors to press, browbeat, and entrap them into fatal contradictions. When our Union was formed, the American colonists, still conscious of the iniquities and oppressive features of the prior practice, carry the rule into the fundamental law of all the states and clothed it with the impregnability of a constitutional enactment. While it lives, as it should live always, let us not misinterpret or discredit or disparage those who invoke its protection." Unquote from Mr. Corbin. One of the pitfalls and dangers facing a witness is illustrated by the recent case of the notorious scientist X, accused by committee and by the press of atom spying. He made the mistake of simply answering no to just such questions. He was never even indicted for espionage, but he was brought to trial for perjury because he answered no. He was recently acquitted by a jury and is a free man, but he is blacklisted out of the universities and also bears the financial burden of his legal defense. He will always be the subject of suspicion by decent citizens who naively believe that the government only indicts those whom it believes to be guilty. He will always have to answer yes when asked if he was ever arrested for a serious crime.
Now, back to the hearing room.
Proceed, Mr. Counsel.
Mr. Mandel, you want to talk about some of your writings which are in use by the State Department Information Service today. Let's do that. Were you the author of...
Mr. Counsel, first may I ask... You brought up the question of your name. Normally that wouldn't be important. Have you ever gone under a different name?
I refuse to answer under my privilege in the Fifth Amendment not to testify against myself, and I want to point out that the right to use a pseudonym is a traditional privilege of writers. I have never written any book under any other name.
Did you have a different name which you used in Communist Party meetings?
The chairman apparently assumes the witness to be stupid. I refuse to answer that question under my privilege in the Fifth Amendment not to testify against myself.
Mr. Mandel.
Let me ask you, Mr. Cohen. You have established the fact that his books have been purchased by the information program and were used in some of our libraries.
They're currently in use in some of our libraries, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. We have, I advised you yesterday, there was one. We now know of at least two writings of Mr. Mandel that are in use. One is Soviet, I think Senator...
Soviet Far East and Central Asia.
Soviet Far East and Central Asia. Now, there's another one I'd like to ask Mr. Mandel about right now. Did you write something entitled Democratic Aspects of Soviet Government Today, which was published in the American Sociological Review in June of 1944? You wrote that, did you not?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, excerpts from that are set forth in a book called Understanding the Russians, which is being used by the State Department Information Centers today. And I would like to read from page 29
Mr.
of that.
Well, may I interrupt at this point for the benefit of the other members of the committee who were not present at the executive session. This is the witness who threatened that if he were exposed and lost his job, that he would attack the committee. I think the committee should know that. Not that we're concerned about it. One communist more or less attacking this committee means nothing to the committee.
Has he told what his job is?
Would you care to have any comment on that, Mr. Chairman?
No, we don't care what attacks you make on the committee. What is your job, incidentally?
Pardon?
What is your job as of today? Where do you work?
The members who were present yesterday at the executive session...
No, where do you work?
You will get your answer.
You will answer where you work?
You will get exactly that answer, Mr.
Counsel, I'm going to have you removed unless you answer the questions. I have to answer them. You can make any speeches you care to. But you answer the question,
Fine.
Where do you work today?
In that case, I will answer it first. I am employed as a copywriter by Elder... New York City.
Now make your speech you care to.
Certainly. It was known to the members of the committee who were present yesterday, and everyone here now knows this, that my present employment has nothing whatever to do with the purposes of this committee. I asked the committee yesterday, in the spirit of fairness, which I doubted it had, not to place my job in jeopardy for that reason. One of the committee members, either the chairman or one of the gentlemen whom I do not recognize offhand, then indicated that I should be willing to pay the price for the activities in which I engage. That was an admission by the committee that it has arrogated itself the right to exact punishment, although it is not a court of law and deprives one of due process of law. That punishment has ranged from fines, ranging from several thousand dollars in the case of people dismissed, up to the fact that you, Senator McCarthy, murdered Major Raymond Kaplan by driving him to the point which he jumped under a truck. Although everybody knows about that thing, that there was nothing that could possibly have merited even the most unimportant punishment for that man. That was my reason.
May I say, Mr. Mandel, that when you refused to tell the committee whether you are engaged in espionage as of today and sabotage as of today, and you assure the committee that if you told the truth, it might incriminate you, I think your employers should know that. If any man is committing sabotage, espionage against his own country, that should be public information.
I make no admission of committing sabotage or espionage at any time or today.
Well, Mr. Mandel, when you say, if I told the truth, I might go to jail. That's in effect what you're saying.
No, sir. Mr. Kaplan left a letter published in the New York Times which said, I quote, you see, when
the
dogs...
Are you quoting the entire letter?
I am quoting certain paragraphs, and the rest I am perfectly willing to have entered.
Mr. Chairman, who is testifying?
Mr. Mandel, when the counsel asks you a question, you will answer it.
I'm sorry, sir. I am not quoting the entire letter.
Chairman, I think we have already entered the entire letter as an exhibit. I think we ought to have the entire letter, or we ought to have nothing.
I am not in having this witness read the letter. It has been received in evidence. In fact, our entire... Strike that.
I don't understand, Mr. Chairman. Am I or am I not permitted at this moment to continue to read what I started to read?
You're not entitled to read Kaplan's confession. We're not asking you about that.
Comment by Mr. Mandel. The quotations from Mr. Kaplan's letter, which McCarthy and Cohn did not want to go over the airwaves, are, quote, I have not done anything in my job which I did not think was in the best interest of the country. You see, once the dogs are set on you, everything you have done since the beginning of time is suspect. I have never done anything that I consider wrong, but I can't take the pressure upon my shoulders anymore. If I don't commit suicide, I am afraid you too, his wife and son, through absolutely no fault of your own, will be continuously hounded for the rest of your lives. Unquote. The letter appeared in the New York Times, March 7th, 1953.
Back to the hearing room.
My question, Mr. Mandel, is, do you think today that the Communist Party is the organization of the most public-spirited and self-sacrificing citizens in the United States of America?
That statement was about the Soviet Union.
Do you believe that the Communist Party of the United States today is the organization of the most public-spirited and most self-sacrificing citizens?
If the First Amendment still obtained in American law, I would answer that question directly. Under the circumstances, I have to rely on my privilege under the Fifth Amendment,
As I have stated it earlier.
Do you think that the form of government in the Soviet Union is better than the form of government in this country today?
I think you gentlemen will be exceedingly interested. I'm sure you'll all be very interested.
You'll answer the question.
I will answer it. Undersecretary of State, Walter Bedell Smith.
No. Could you answer, could you tell us, do you think, you can answer that yes or no. Do you think?
I will answer it.
May we get an answer,
yes
Mr.
or no,
Chairman?
Or otherwise eventually, and you will get an answer.
Do we have to wait eventually until the witness wants
to? It's a simple question. You will answer it yes or no. And again, we've been giving you people a great deal of latitude. We'll continue. You can make any speech you want to after you've made your answer.
All right.
You'll first make your answer.
Fine. In that case, I will answer again under the Fifth Amendment, although I am very reluctant to do so and would much prefer to state my honest opinion.
You are refusing to answer whether you think the communist form of government is superior to ours. Is that the question?
That was the question, Mr. Chairman.
You're refusing. And do you honestly feel that if you told us the truth in answer to that question, that that might tend to incriminate you?
That is my understanding of certain laws now on the books.
Comment by Mr. Mandel. It is not just a simple question, as McCarthy phrased it. Governments are judged by what they do for the people. A quotation from General Walter Bedell Smith, former ambassador to Moscow, then head of the Central Intelligence Agency, and now Undersecretary of State in the Eisenhower administration. The quotation which McCarthy would not permit to be read reads as follows. I quote him. The Soviet Union is setting a higher cultural standard within its borders, I believe, than exists anywhere else in the world. I say that advisedly. I mean, at least according to my tastes, the Soviet radio, the Soviet ballet, the opera, their puppet theaters, things of that sort, are based on a higher cultural level than that which public demand dictates in this country. Unquote from General Smith. His testimony before a House Subcommittee on Foreign Affairs.
Back to the hearing room.
Proceed, Mr. Counsel.
Yeah. Now, the next question is this. Do you believe the cause of the United States and the United Nations in Korea today is a just cause?
As I told the McCarran Committee last year, I think the job is to stop the war and get out. It will serve no purpose whatever to rehash things over which passions have raged for 2 years.
Mr. Mandel, you will first answer the question, then you can explain your answer. The question was, do you think the United Nations...
Do you think that the cause of the United States and the United Nations in Korea is a just cause?
I do not, and here, sir, is my explanation.
Very well.
In the New York Herald Tribune of November 1st, 1949, there's an interview with the Minister of the Armed Forces of South Korea, Mr. Sim. He said, I quote, "If we had our own way, we would, I am sure, have started up already South Korea. But we had to wait until they, American government leaders, are ready. They keep telling us, quote within quote, no, 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 wait, you are not ready, unquote." Mr. Sin continues, "We are strong enough to march up and take Pyongyang, the northern capital, within a few days," unquote. The end of the story is, Mr. Sin came to Tokyo last week and saw General Douglas MacArthur and other high American military officials. Now, on June 5th, 1950, just 14 or 15 days before the outbreak of the war, apparently we were ready. General Roberts, chief of the U.S. military mission in Korea, said as follows in a press interview. I quote him, "In Korea, the American taxpayer has an army that is a fine watchdog over the investments placed in this country." That's what we're fighting for, my interjection there. "The U.S. military advisory group was a living demonstration of how an intelligent and intensive investment of 500 combat-hardened American men and officers can train 100,000 people who will do the shooting for you." The Asians appreciate that, I'm sure. My interjection again. I continue. "I have at least 12 to 14 Americans with each division. They work with the Korean officers."
There will be no more of that. If you want to insert a newspaper article in record, it will be received.
Fine, there it is.
Mr. Mandel, may I inquire? Obviously, your private views are your own, but I'm a little curious about this book.
Test, test.
I would assume offhand that to do a book like the Soviet Far East and Central Asia, and to do it authentically, you would have to have traveled some over there. Did you travel in that area?
I was in the Soviet Union. I was not in that area. Einstein was never inside the atom. He seems to be able to understand it.
Well, now, I didn't ask for any levity. I was asking a fair question, because if a man writes and writes authentically on some subject, he either depends on secondhand sources in a library, or he goes and interviews people on the ground.
Sir, I have lived all my life in this country, but for 1 year in Russia. I was born here. I do not think that I am as competent to write a book on the United States, and I have traveled widely in this country. I do not think that I am as competent to write a book on the United States as I am to write a book on Russia. Because to write a book about a country requires more than living in it, traveling in it, even if one has pretty good eyes. One has to study a country. One has to use all its scholarly and other resources.
Right, I got less than
and I have had the privilege of utilizing one of the finest collections in this country, the collection of the Herbert Hoover Institute at Stanford University, which engaged me as a fellow on the basis of books I had previously written, including that book, which it deemed to merit my engagement as an expert on Russia.
Did you go to the Lenin School when you were in Moscow?
I was 14 years of age when I went there. I went to Moscow State University and studied biochemistry.
Now, did you ever attend the Lenin School?
No, sir, I never attended the Lenin School. Don't even know where it is.
And what schools did you attend in Moscow?
I attended the Moscow State University and studied biochemistry. Mm-hmm. My records are on file with City College in New York.
For 1 year?
For somewhat less than 1 year.
Okay, now we're going to talk about a recent murder that took place, a hate crime that took place in the Bay Area.
Okay, so on November 12th in El Sobrante, California, near Richmond, a man named William Sims was the victim of a hate crime perpetrated by three alleged white supremacists. According to Contra Costa County Sheriffs, a group of men jumped Sims inside the Capri Club, a pool hall in the 4100 block of Appian Way in El Sobrante. They robbed him, beat him, and shot him, leaving him to die on a roadway. So one person has been arrested, Daniel Porter Kelly of Richmond, being charged with murder, robbery, and a hate crime enhancement. Because even the authorities believe that race was a factor in Sims' death. Warrants have been issued for 31-year-old Daniel Ortega, who also resides in Richmond or in Novato, and for 32-year-old Ray Simmons of Hercules. So, this is a local example of a phenomenon that has existed for as long as this country has, but that has seen a huge uptick in the last two and a half weeks since the election. So I have some figures here from the Southern Poverty Law Center, who tracks crimes and organizing trajectories of various hate groups throughout the country. This is the second update from the Southern Poverty Law Center's effort to collect reports of hateful incidents of harassment across the country. These are figures from between the 9th and the 16th of November. The total number of incidents has risen. The trend line points to a steady drop-off. Around 65% of the incidents collected occurred in the first 3 days following the election. Now, mind you, these are incidents ranging from this particular, from the killing of William Sims to children in schools and people walking down the street who are assaulted, who have their hijabs taken from them. Other patterns pointed out previously are holding as well, notably that anti-immigrant incidents remain the top type of harassment reported, and that nearly 40% of all incidents occurred in educational, that is K through 12 and university institutions. So I'm looking at a chart here. The number of reported incidents on November 9th, the day after the election, soared well over 150 and saw a steady decline after that. Incidents by type rank, so the Southern Poverty Law Center ranks them by number. Anti-immigrant violence, 206 incidents. Anti-black, 151. Anti-LGBT, 80. Swastika vandalism, 60 incidents. Anti-Muslim incidents, 51. Anti-women incidents, 36. The Southern Poverty Law Center says they keep track of anti-Trump incidents as well, and say that they numbered 22-27. Ready? So a couple of the particulars here. In Tennessee, an American-born grandson was told by told by some white kids that they will be getting a ticket out of the U.S. soon. In Washington State, a racial slur was discovered spray-painted on Spokane's Martin Luther King Jr. Family Outreach Center. Dozens of people gathered in solidarity to denounce the act, paint over the graffiti. Staff at the center found the graffiti on the side of the building when they came in to work Tuesday morning. Frida Grandy, the center's director, said some of the children... So, in Boston, this is a first-person account. As I walked home tonight, a man on the street decided he didn't like my face. You think that's funny, dirty bitch? I'll spit on you, you dirty bitch. Can smell the Africa on you. Oh my god. So, I think it will depress us even more if I read through every single one of these. But the point is that these incidents and incidences like this have grown as people who carry various forms of prejudice are empowered by their new president-elect and the new administration that is being built around white supremacy. So, I'm gonna give it over to Gerald here in a second to discuss some other pieces of news. Let's see. So, ready? All right.
You know, recently, a football player has taken center stage in the critique of so-called American patriotism. And we think there's some very important political matters that need to be dealt with here, because the people that have stepped up and joined Kaepernick, for the most part, are children. All over this land, we have had kids taking a knee. Here in Oakland, we had at Castlemont High School, the entire football team took a knee. That is, refused to stand for the Star Spangled Banner. The whole band laid on their backs with their hands up, signifying hands up, don't shoot. This has become a national phenomenon. Let me see if I can share with you some of what's going on, because it's actually pretty satisfying, almost amazing, to see all of the stuff that's going on here. For instance, in Minneapolis, a South High School knelt on September the 16th. And it's soccer teams, professional ball players, football players on the 49ers and off, not on only on the 49ers, but on other teams. For instance, the Miami Dolphins, the St. Louis Rams, the Kansas City Chiefs, the New England Patriots, and the Denver Broncos. And these numbers continue to grow. Most recently, Mr. Kaepernick actually spoke up on another matter, and that is Fidel Castro, of the longtime revolutionary leader of Cuba, recently died. And, well, to be perfectly blunt, the head-fixing industry went into high gear, and they're telling us how lucky we are to be in this great democracy where our children are being assaulted daily because of the color of their skin. And they said Mr. Kaepernick expressed some skepticism on this matter of this denunciation of Mr. Castro. And they said basically to him, "What? You're not going to get involved in the hysteria against Cuba?" And Mr. Kaepernick basically, they said, "Castro destroyed families," because indeed many families were divided when they left. Some families, members of families, left and went to Florida. Some stayed in Cuba. So yes, families were separated. Mr. Kaepernick answered very simply by saying, "Yes, indeed. Indeed, some families were separated. And also, mass incarceration here in America separates families also." I think he was right. But to just go on here, it's now become a legal matter because not only have some children's lives been threatened with murder in some parts of the country, people have pushed back, and people need to know what I want to convey to you is you actually have some rights on this matter. The Supreme Court ruled in 1943 that public schools may not constitutionally force students to salute the flag. Lee Rowland, the First Amendment attorney who works with the ACLU, told Intercept, and I quote, "That ruling is crystal clear about a student's right not to be compelled into patriotism by their government, and it's over 70 years old." The ruling that Rowland references came after many Jehovah's Witnesses in the United States began to refuse to salute the flag in solidarity with their brethren in Nazi Germany, who were being arrested for refusing to salute that country's fascist flag. So just know the law, insofar as it exists, is on your side. The court ruled in favor of families over and over again that have challenged the so-called state officials that threatened them. And in his opinion, the Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson wrote, and I will quote him, "Compulsory unification of opinion leaves only the unanimity of the graveyard." In different situations, this is a quote about a suspension and a termination that someone faced taking the knee in America. And I quote, "I'm standing up for the injustice that happens to black people every day, not just cops killing black people. We are disrespected and mistreated everywhere we go on a daily basis because of our skin color, and I'm sick of it." This is a young man that said this after taking the knee and being terminated and suspended. Mike Open, a junior at Daugherty Memorial High School, made that comment. A student at Lower Lake High School in Lower Lake, California. We call it Clear Lake. his name, Lenali Thomas, was punished for the first time since she began, sitting out the Pledge of Allegiance in the second grade. Thomas, a member of the Native Americans Pomo tribe, is protesting the United States' systematic abuse of Native peoples. After a teacher lowered her grade for sitting, the school moved Thomas to a class with a different teacher. The teacher told me I was being disrespectful and I was pretty mad, Leilani told ABC 10. Quote, she was being disrespectful to me also, saying I was making bad choices and I don't have the choice to sit during the pledge. Well, actually, that child, as millions of others, do have the right to sit. Okay, that's for Kaepernick. We promise to get back to Castro at our next broadcast, or at a future broadcast. We have some very interesting, we have some very interesting interviews lined up here. I want to also point out that recently, this is news here, the Oakland Unified School District Chief Administrator just left Oakland for a higher paying job. He's getting paid $400,000. He just left Oakland to go to Washington, D.C. for a higher position to privatize the schools. And it's just, I don't know, I feel a little bitter. I feel bitter because not one administrator has stayed in this school. The last four administrators we've had here in Oakland have been here less than 2 years per administrator. Is Oakland just a stepping stone for these petty bourgeois hustlers on the make? Or do our children deserve committed educators who take the job because they want to do a decent job and help us out of this horrible mess we have in Oakland in terms of the quality of education we provide in our schools? Okay. Well, Senti, it's that time, baby. Right now, we have Brother Travis here, who recently went to the Dakota Access Pipeline camps. He made a wonderful film. Actually, I wanted to play the film. Is that possible? Would they be able to hear, Okay, well, why don't you guys start off your interview, and I will search for it. Maybe you can help me out a little bit. Senti, you're the man.
We're here to talk a little bit about the resistance against the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. And you spent some time out there, and I was hoping that you could give us some updates on what is going down there at the moment.
Sure. My name is Travis Shermer. I spent some time at the Sacred Stone Camp, assisting in some of the actions to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I have a recent news update. This news came out yesterday. So the Army Corps of Engineers wrote a letter and delivered it to the Standing Rock chairman, Dave Archambault. And this letter was given to him the day after Thanksgiving, and it informed him that the Corps planned to close access to the main camp at Sacred Stone. The plan is to create a what they call a free speech zone that is south of the Cannonball River, and that is farther away than the current camp is from the construction of the pipeline. The reason being given for this eviction of the camp is, quote, because emergency services can't access and protect the demonstrators. They also said that after December 5th, anyone found at the camp can be charged with trespass and arrested. And the chairman, David Archambault, responded to that letter.
I'm going to read the public statement from Chairman Archambault on the Army Corps' decision to evict the encampment on December 5th. The following statement from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's Chairman Dave Archambault II can be quoted in part or in full. Today, we were notified by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that on December 5th, they will close all lands north of the Cannonball River, which is where the Osseti-Sakowin camp is located. The letter states that the lands will be closed to public access for safety concerns and that they will allow for a free speech zone south of the Cannonball River on Army Corps lands. Our tribe is deeply disappointed in this decision by the United States, but our resolve to protect our water is stronger than ever. The best way to protect people during the winter and reduce the risk of conflict between water protectors and militarized police is to deny the easement for the Ohare Crossing and deny it now. We ask that everyone who can appeal to President Obama and the Army Corps of Engineers to consider the future of our people and rescind all permits and deny the easement to cross the Missouri River just north of our reservation and straight through our treaty lands. When the Dakota Access Pipeline chose this route, they did not consider our strong opposition. Our concerns were clearly articulated directly to them in a tribal council meeting held on September 30th, 2014, where DAPL and the ND Public Service Commission came to us with this route. Again, we ask that the United States stop the pipeline and move it outside our ancestral and treaty lands. It is both unfortunate and disrespectful that this announcement comes the day after this country celebrates Thanksgiving, a historic exchange of goodwill between Native Americans and first immigrants from Europe. Although the news is saddening, it is not at all surprising given the last 500 years of the mistreatment of our people. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe stands united with more than 300 tribal nations and the water protectors who are here peacefully protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline to bolster Indigenous people's rights. We continue to fight for these rights, which continue to be eroded. Although we have suffered much, we still have hope that the president will act on his commitment to close the chapter of broken promises to our people and especially our children. And once again, that was the statement, public statement from Chairman Archambault on the Army Corps decision. And there is also a statement that was released by the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe that I am going to share with you as well. Give me just one moment. This letter responds to your correspondence dated November 25th, 2016, announcing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers plan to close certain corps-managed lands to all public use and access effective December 5th, 2016. You state that this decision is necessary to protect the general public from the violent confrontations between protesters and law enforcement officials that have occurred in this area and to prevent death, illness, or serious injury to inhabitants of encampments due to the harsh North Dakota winter conditions. You have warned that anyone found outside of a so-called free speech zone will be considered trespassing and may be subject to prosecution under federal, state, and local laws. You have asked me to encourage members of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, as well as any non-members who support you, who are located in the encampments north of the Cannonball River on corpse lands, to immediately and peacefully move to the free speech zone. The area north of the Cannonball River is both the ancestral homeland of the Lakota people and inside the boundaries of the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, a treaty that has not been abrogated and a law that governs us all. The best of these lands have already been unjustly taken and flooded by the corpse and the disastrous Pick Sloan legislation. We will no longer allow our rights as a tribe or as indigenous people as a whole to continue to be eroded. This decision comes on the heels of the Thanksgiving holiday is not only disrespectful, but continues the cycle of racism and oppression imposed on our people and our lands throughout history. We ask that the corpse and the United States reconsider this decision. Treaties are the supreme law of the land, and the Constitution of the United States demands that they be respected. Removal from Sioux treaty lands should be the choice of the Osseti Sakowan camp north of the Cannonball River, nor the United States, which has been violating our rights for hundreds of years. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe stands with more than 300 tribal nations and the water protectors who are here peacefully protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline while defending the rights of indigenous people. Furthermore, your letter dangerously and profoundly misunderstands the basic function and status of a tribal government and its elected leaders. I am the chief executive of a sovereign nation that is comprised of individual citizens with physical territory within the exterior boundaries the state of South Dakota. Under the laws of the United States, my government lacks jurisdiction at Cannonball, but more importantly, I no more control the acts and behaviors of Cheyenne River Sioux tribal members or non-member water protectors at the Cannonball site than you do, Henderson. As set forth above, even if I could control the water protectors, I recognize and respect their rights under the Constitution of the United States to peacefully assemble in prayerful protest against the cultural and environmental atrocity that is the Dakota Access Pipeline. I would not use my authority, which is based on the consent of my citizens, to curtail their human and constitutional rights. Perhaps the most terrifying aspect of your letter is your acknowledgement of the stark reality that the confrontation between our peaceful water protectors and law enforcement could result in death or serious injury, a fact demonstrated by the brutal attack on Sophia Walensky by North Dakota police last week. But in the very next paragraph, you guarantee that further confrontations will occur by promising that these peaceful people will be trespassing on closed areas, and you threaten that they will do so at their own risk and assume any and all corresponding liabilities for their unlawful presence and occupation of such lands. I take your letter as issuing a direct and irresponsible threat to the water protectors. It appears to further empower the militarized police force that has been brutalizing and terrorizing our water protectors while imposing the blame and the risk on unarmed, peaceful people. We have pleaded for the protection of the United States. Your letter makes a grave and dangerous mistake. Federal efforts to de-escalate the violence should be aimed at the wrongdoers, not our peaceful people. Sincerely, Chairman Harold Frazier of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. And once again, that is the formal response from the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers eviction notice for December 5th. Do you have any thoughts that you would like to share with us on your experience there, spending some time at the encampment, or anything important that you think viewers should know or hear at this moment?
Well, just in response to what was just said and discussed, the state of North Dakota just recently approved $10 million for the police to remain around the construction areas of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And the water protectors and the people at camp have been speaking out about constant helicopter surveillance and plane surveillance and lots and lots of money and resources going towards constant surveillance and policing of this this movement. And I went to the Sacred Stone Camp in early September, right after private security guards released attack dogs on peaceful protesters. And when I was there, it seemed like the police and the security guards were told to kind of back down. But the surveillance and they have these vehicles called MRAPs, which are mine-resistant armored personnel carriers, and they're deploying this militarized police response. Even when the cops aren't attacking people, they're constantly using military-grade surveillance and oppression tactics against these peaceful water protectors. And I guess that's my main update for now.
Can you tell us anything about this incident with Sophia Wilansky? Like, what exactly happened with that, and who is Sophia Wilansky, and what was this incident in question last Sunday?
Sophia Wilansky is a 21-year-old woman from the Bronx who is an activist who traveled to Standing Rock to support the water protectors. And her and several hundred protectors tried to, as far as I understand, they in the late hours of the night about a week ago, they had a confrontation with police and private security guards as the protectors tried to block construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And the police and security guards sprayed all of the protectors were nearby in freezing cold weather with fire hoses that people who were hit claimed were laced with chemicals. Over 300 people had to be treated for burns on their eyes and faces, and they said that they were targeted, or the hoses were targeting their faces and hands and exposed skin. And Sophia Wilansky was critically injured. Her and witnesses all agree and claim that the police launched a grenade at her, and witnesses were saying that the police would pull the tab on the grenade and wait till it was about to explode and then throw it so that it would explode without giving people time to get away from it. And that one of these grenades, these flash grenades or whatever kind of grenade it was, severely injured Sophia's arm. She's still in the hospital. Her arm is in critical condition, and it's unclear if it will need to be amputated or what's going to happen with that.
There is a GoFundMe page to raise money for Sophia Wilansky's medical fund, the case that her arm would be amputated. Either way, she's undergoing intensive surgery at the moment, and so money is needed to cover her medical funds. There is a GoFundMe page entitled Medical Fund for Sophia Wolanski, and the goal is $500,000, and at the moment, $389,874 have been raised. And a lot of people have demonstrated support for her. There was another violent incident within the last week, too. This woman, Vanessa, also known as Suzy, I'm going to read you the description on this case. Vanessa has been on the front lines fighting DAPL and working security for Osseti Sakowin since September 11th. During the action on November 20th at the Backwater Bridge, she was shot in the eye with a tear gas canister 6 feet away. It was aimed directly at her face by a Morton County officer. She was seen at Bismarck Sanford Hospital and released because she had no insurance. She has a detached retina and needs surgery to ensure her vision. She is now seeking medical attention in Fargo. Donations will be used for the cost of the two ER visits, surgery, medications, and recovery. So that is another urgent medical fundraiser that emerged from the violence against water protectors at Standing Rock. That is a GoFundMe page as well. The goal for this GoFundMe is $200,000, and $63,857 have been raised so far. And if you want to look it up, it's Medical Fund for Vanessa, and then in parentheses, Sue, and then the letter Z. There's one more grim news update about Standing Rock that I wanted to mention, and this is about the case of Red Fawn, who has been framed with a murder charge during one incident at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, where the Morton County Police Department is claiming that she fired live rounds at a police officer, even though there were other people who were around at that time and can confirm that did not occur. And there is video recordings, too, that day of the incident in question. But I'm going to read this to you real quick. Dakota pipeline protesters say activist accused of shooting at police is a pacifist. Red Fawn Fallis saved her from the violence and chaos. On the 22nd of October, when police arrested more than 120 people protesting against the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, Lauren Howland was caught in the middle and suffered a broken wrist when she said an officer attacked her. Fallis, a 37-year-old Native American protester known as a mother to many of the youth at the Standing Rock protest in North Dakota, personally came back into the front lines and wheeled us all out. Howland, 21, recalled, she's a protector. Howland and other youth protesters said that they were devastated to find out a week later that local police arrested Fallis and charged her with attempted murder, saying that she had pulled out a .38 revolver and fired three gunshots at police during another mass arrest incident. The Morton County Sheriff's Office has held up the charges as an example of what it says is the violent and illegal behavior of Native American protesters as standoffs continue to erupt at the indigenous demonstrations against the $3.7 billion oil pipeline. But Fallis's close friends and supporters are questioning the circumstances of her arrest, telling The Guardian that the firearm accusations were inconceivable and comparing her to famous Native American political prisoners such as Leonard Peltier. To some pipeline protesters who describe Fallas is a passionate activist dedicated to peaceful tactics. Her detention is the latest sign that North Dakota police are aggressively targeting a growing movement and will go to great lengths to protect a powerful corporation threatening sacred tribal lands. None of us could believe it. We just collectively burst into tears, said Irwin Wise, a 26-year-old protester and member of the Chicarilla, Apache, and Laguna Pueblo tribes. We are all terrified. The charges, which could result in a 20-year prison sentence, mark the latest case to ignite fierce tensions between law enforcement officials and Native Americans as the construction of Energy Transfer Partners pipeline gets closer to the Missouri River and tribal camps fighting the project. Police officials who claim that the protest actions have been illegal and dangerous have made more than 400 arrests, charging activists and journalists for rioting, trespassing, resisting arrest, conspiracy, and other serious felonies. Human rights groups have sharply condemned local police for their response, which has involved pepper spray, tear gas, riot gear, army tanks, and questionable jail conditions. On 27th of October, when police arrested 141 people who set up camps in the path of construction, officers attempted to arrest Fallas on the local highway, claiming she was being an instigator and acting disorderly. In a news alert released on Monday, the sheriff's office alleged that Fallas resisted arrest and fired three shots, causing the ground to explode. No one was injured. It wasn't because she was trying to aim away from law enforcement. It was because it was our lucky day, said Captain Brian Newwind, who said he was standing 2 feet from her. Law enforcement showed restraint. We did not fire upon her. The news of her charges, which also include preventing arrest, carrying a concealed firearm, and marijuana possession, shocked members of the International Indigenous Youth Council, which is made up of adolescents and young adults who have been on the front lines of numerous demonstrations. Anyone at camp that needs help, she's always been the one to stand up, said Maya Stevens, a 22-year-old youth council member who has known Fala since she was a child. She wouldn't do nothing like that. Where is the proof? Asked for copies of any footage of the arrest or photos of the firearm, a spokeswoman for the sheriff said that is all the evidence that will not be released until the investigation is complete. Fallas is a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe and has previously lived in North Dakota, but is currently based in Denver, Colorado. Stevens said that Fallas' mother, a longtime family friend, recently died and that Fallas was protesting against the pipeline in her honor. Stevens, who had to leave the protests to return to her Colorado home, said she plans to soon head back to Standing Rock to fight for Fallas' release. I'm going to sit there as many nights as I need until she gets out. Howland said that Fallas made a point of reminding youth activists to stay peaceful and prayerful and never resort to violence. Wise, who helps watch over 18 young people who share the youth council camp, said Fallas had a four-wheeler vehicle and often helped rescue protesters who needed medical attention during police confrontations. It didn't surprise me that they are targeting Red Fawn because she's definitely an asset to our community, said Wise, who got emotional describing Fallas' role on camp. She's the person who comes in to check on me to make sure I'm doing self-care. On social media, many have supported Fallas with the hashtag Free Red Fawn, and some have compared her to Leonard Peltier, a Native activist and former member of the American Indian Movement who was convicted of aiding in the killing of two FBI agents in 1975. Many at the camp said it was very hard to believe Fallas could have been carrying a gun, given that Native elders had made clear that no one should be armed at Standing Rock. She didn't seem like she was rebellious or radical, said Arlana Curley, a Cheyenne River Sioux tribe member, adding about law enforcement. They're trying their best to make us as Native Americans look like we are the bad people. And one last thing on that note of Red Fawn is because she is incarcerated right now, she does need support from people. And support can look like many things, but in this case it looks like sending her letters and writing to her. And so if you want to send Red Fawn a letter, then you should go to the Facebook page, Ghost Town Prisoner Support. If you go to the Facebook page, Ghost Town Prisoner Support, there is mailing information, so you can write her a letter and send her a letter. And she responds. She responded to a letter that we sent during a letter writing night last week, and it was really exciting to get her response. So make sure to do that if you have time. And then is there any other news or anything positive. I remember you mentioned something about veterans. Do you want to share that news with people?
Yes, just a few more notes. One exciting positive note is that over 200 veterans are planning on traveling to the Standing Rock, the Sacred Stone Camp, in order to protect the protectors themselves from police oppression. They have a GoFundMe to help fund their traveling and their expenses. If you Google veteran support for Standing Rock, their GoFundMe will come up. Couple more notes also that Gerald wanted me to mention. I am in a group with Gerald called Liberated Lens, and if you search Liberated Lens on YouTube, there are a few original pieces, one short documentary that I made, and several other videos about Standing Rock that you can access. The one that I made is just called No Dapple, No D-A-P-L. I think it's a really crucial time that everybody try to support in whatever way you can. If you go to Standing Rock Camp, if you search that on Google, the first link that comes up is the Standing Rock website. And if you go on there, there's a donation button. Any contributions are much needed at this time. Between 400 and 500 people have been arrested so far. Legal expenses are needed. General expenses for the campers are needed, and it's a crucial time for everybody to support the movement. So thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. And one last piece of good news about Standing Rock that I wanted to share before passing off the mic is that there was a UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, crowdfunding campaign to establish a health clinic partnership at Standing Rock, and that has raised more than $211,000 within the last 2 weeks, exceeding the original $150,000 goal. So that's really exciting, because that means that these violent incidents that we talked about involving like Susie and Sophia Walensky could be like mitigated and dealt with and responded with on the ground immediately if there is a health clinic. And it's really awesome that there are people from UCSF who are materializing that vision and making that happen.
One more thing too, the website to check out, or another website to check out for donations, is sacredstonecamp.org.
Hold on a minute. You know what? I just want to make a few quick points, because we have to move on. We have people here. We have information, but this is news that you can use. When you listen to Slavery Vote, keep a piece of paper handy and a pen, because we're not talking just to hear ourselves talk here. We're trying to guide people as to concrete actions that you can take to help your working class people resist capitalist tyranny. Now, just a quick quote. When asked by an anthropologist what the Indians called America before the white man came, an Indian said simply, "Ours." This is what we're dealing with here. Now, I want to just tell you, I'm from the black community, so I'm dealing with brothers and sisters daily. And unfortunately, to be honest, I think many of us, we don't quite see what's happening here in Standing Rock because of the Indians talking about their sacred lands. We hear the chants, things like this. And people, unfortunately, get caught up and say, well, yeah, you know what, that ain't got nothing to do with me. Nah, man, I ain't into all of that. Well, can I please remind our brothers and sisters that the civil rights movement in the United States that eventually broke and smashed Jim Crow was a deeply religious movement at its onset. We were constantly singing religious songs. It was led by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Dr. King, the primary leader of the civil rights movement in the South, was a preacher himself. Praying at our functions was a very common thing. Now, I was a youth from New York. I was hostile to that. I didn't want to know the goddamn praying, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but guess what? That's what kept people going. Demonstration after demonstration, after march, after insult, after attack. Let's take another look at our Indian or Native American brothers and sisters in this vital struggle. I also have to mention, but I can't go into it right now due to lack of time, that our trade union movement is unfortunately split on this issue. So in the name of jobs, we have some of our trade union leaders. I'm talking about Hoffa particularly, the leader of the Teamsters, have issued, I don't know, man, my heart is sick, support to the police assault on the Native Americans. Does that mean that the trade unions are against this struggle? No, it does not. It means that our corrupted leadership, which calls out we have to replace these people, because they're not doing a very good job at defending our rights. The trade unions have gone from 50% in the 50s to 36% before Reagan took power, to now 11% of the workforce is trade unions. That looks like we've been going backwards. And we've been going backwards because the leadership is backwards. We do not accept or respect the words of people like James Hoffa, Callahan, O'Sullivan, and the rest of these misleaders. That's what they are. Don't be confused and do not ascribe their reactionary attitudes to the mass of workers. The fact is that we're split. There are unions that are for this struggle. My longshoremen are for it. The ILWU Local 10, for it. SEIU, the Service and Employees International Union, for it. The California Nurses Association, for it. United Electrical Workers, for it. So understand, we are split. And when we're split, we're paralyzed and we're weak. We need to find a way to unify. But I don't want people to dismiss the whole working class, all of the working people. I'm working class, and you too are probably working class, the listeners of this program. Okay, we want to move on. So we're going to move on now to our second interview with Tarnal Abbott.
All right, everyone, Eric here. I'm sitting here with Tarnal Abbott from the Richmond Progressive Alliance. Would you tell us a little bit about yourself, Tarnal, and about also the Progressive Alliance?
Hi, yeah, I'm not here representing the Richmond Progressive Alliance, but yes, I've worked with the RPA, as we call it, for since its inception about, I don't know, 11, 12 years ago. And we exist, or were formed, and attempt to take the city of Richmond political forces back to the people of Richmond from the forces of Chevron. And what we do is we organize on a local level. We go door to door and encourage people to run for local offices and sit on different city boards and commissions. We have managed to get people elected onto our city council who do not take any corporate donations, because our history in Richmond has been one of major corporations, mostly Chevron, handing money basically to the campaigns of city council candidates. It's not just Chevron. It has also been the beverages, you know, like Coca-Cola, the, I forget what it's called, the exact beverage association, realtor interests, developers interests, things like that. In this last November, we did manage to elect two city council members from our progressive perspective who did not take corporate donations, Ben Choi and Melvin Willis. And so what this means is that the progressives will now have a majority voice on the city council, which is the first time in history that this has happened. We also managed to pass a rent control measure because the people are being so displaced and hurt by this onslaught of the dot-coms and gentrification that we just, you know, we knew we had to do something to help people. So we worked really hard on this. And of course, now the hard work of carrying through on all of that is about to begin.
So you're here with us today because you recently went to Standing Rock, and we wanted to get your take on that. So how long were you there, and what led you to go?
I was not there for very long. I was only there for 5 days. I had back-to-back speaking engagements before and after, so that's what limited my time, essentially. I would have loved to stay longer. What motivated me to go, there were a number of things, but first and foremost, I am a grandmother, and I went there because I'm a grandmother, because we all need clean water, and I've been struggling in my own community for clean water on the South Richmond shoreline, which has been heavily contaminated by a former Stauffer Chemical and Zeneca plant that has polluted our shoreline, essentially, and that water goes directly into San Francisco Bay. We're all connected by the water, and when you pollute the water in one place, it shows up somewhere else, like in our own bodies. And years ago, before the RPA was actually formed, I met a woman from Nigeria. Her name was Annie Brasibi, and she came and talked to us about the struggle there in the Niger Delta against Chevron, and how the people were fighting for clean water in their community, and the repressive techniques of the government funded by the oil company to shoot at people, basically. So we're all in this struggle together, and we all live downstream, so that's why I went.
We all live downstream. That's a powerful way to frame that, I think. I'm curious also what day today was like for you, the few days that you were there, and what was maybe the most powerful sort of particular experience that you had.
It's a little hard to separate out the most powerful, but in terms of the day today, feeling sort of aged and decrepit and week, I opted to stay in a hotel in Bismarck. There's only one hotel really near the camp, and it was it's a casino run by the tribe, and it's called the Prairie Knights Inn or Casino. That was full up, so I ended up staying in a hotel in Bismarck. I went with a friend. We rented a car, and because the government forces had closed the direct highway, we took a circuitous route, which took about an hour drive each way. So we went back and forth during daylight hours. And we mostly what we did is we wandered around the camp and talked to people. We also picked up supplies in Bismarck, specific supplies that we were asked if we could bring, which included some specific art supplies, warm blankets, tent stakes, flashlights and batteries, warm socks. I mean, you know, I'm a California girl, and on a sunny day at 27 degrees, I was freezing, and I had 4 layers on. So, you know, I know people get used to the weather and so on, but it's no joke. You have to really dress warm. we talked to one of the most powerful things that happened was as the day, the sun was setting, the temperature starts to drop, and we were walking around the camp, and these two women stopped their car and talked to us, and they were from the leadership of the camp. These were Native women, and they asked us as we met people while we were walking around if we would make sure to tell them to get shelter in the common areas, to get shelter from the cold, that people are told to go there and be self-sufficient, but they were really worried. They didn't want anybody suffering from the cold, and to please come in and get help, ask for help when they need it. And that was just, you know, it was so symptomatic of every time we met somebody or talked to somebody, it was like, welcome, thank you for coming, we need you, we love you, you know, you're share with us. That sort of sentiment was really pervasive throughout the camp, you know, from everybody that we talked to, and people are looking at each other, they're talking to each other. It was like being in a real community again, which is something that I haven't felt in a long time. The other thing that was so compelling for me was just being the night that on the 20th, when the people were protesting on the bridge. They don't call it protesting. They consider themselves water protectors, and the water protectors were on the bridge, and the police were targeting them with the water high pressure fire hoses or water cannon and shooting percussion grenades and tear gas, and all this was happening. I was actually not there. I was in the hotel room, but I was watching it on a live stream from someone in the who was there, and I just was overcome with horror. And how can we allow this to happen? How can they do that? And how can people in this country allow this to go on and on and on? I mean, and yet, you know, we have seen these things happen before, and every time they happen, we have to speak up and not be afraid. We have to speak as loudly as we can wherever we are, and I think that's the call for now, to not be immobilized by that fear, but to take action where we are and do what we can, because it isn't just, you know, the right-wing Morton County Sheriff's Department that is doing this. This is happening all over our country, and all people have to stand together and fight that that force of fascism. That's what it is. It's the collusion of the government with the oil barons of our era, or the 1%, or whatever you want to call it. It's the hard iron fist. It's the hard iron heel of fascism. That's what it is.
Absolutely. And so this is a community that is in which people are really strongly looking out for one another, and that has within itself the ability to sustain, to be self-sustaining for a long, long time. We heard in our previous interview the update about the recent Army Corps of Engineers decision to order an eviction. I'm wondering what you think that will look like, and what will happen next, and, you know, whether or not we can go and be supportive as things build up to that. What can we all do, at least from here?
Yeah, there's a number of different things on this. One, this morning I listened to online broadcast from the leader of the tribe, Mr. Archambault, the chief, and he, in his interview, he says that he doesn't think that there's going to be a forcible, violent eviction. His interpretation of what that letter is from the Army Corps of Engineers is that they're trying to, they're saying there is danger. If you're there, you're at your own risk. We, the Army Corps of Engineers, are not going to take responsibility for whatever happens to you. It's an interview that's worth watching, and paying close attention to. They've got several different people who speak at that press conference. And this, I think this was either on Friday or Saturday of this week that that press conference occurred. I just want to also mention the fact that the veterans who are planning to be there in support of the people, the last number I heard was 1,500 people, veterans have signed up to be there. I think the threat is real from the local Morton County Sheriff's Department. Of course, they don't have the capacity to deal with thousands and thousands of people. However, apparently the governor has issued or decided to give them a huge influx of money. I am afraid, but I would go back if I felt that my presence would be beneficial. I want to go back. I don't know that I can right now. Yes, I think people can still go there, and the tribe will do whatever they can to protect people. The main thing is, I don't know that the federal government will intervene or not. Obama's been very hands-off on this. My memory of the civil rights movement is that although Johnson was a war criminal, he did step in and he sent federal troops to protect human rights in the South. That did happen. And that needs to happen now. People need to be protected from the local law enforcement and from the National Guard, or the National Guard needs to be ordered to stand down. And that, I would urge everybody, yeah, I know the phone lines are jammed to the White House, so send an email, a letter, whatever it is, and call your local senator or your senator and congressman and urge the same thing. I have a great amount of fear, but my hope is overriding my fear. And that was how I got there in the first place. I had to get over that fear. I'm fearful every day, but right here and everywhere else about what's coming. And I got to listen to people like Howard Zinn, who said the more the repression comes, the stronger you have to stand up and say something about it.
Thank you so much for your words of wisdom and strength. I think that's something that I know I need to hear a lot more than usual these days. I have in front of me your letter with a list of really concrete recommendations about how support can be provided from here. Do you mind if I read some of this?
Fine, yeah. It's not complete. But...
No. So not complete, but... monetary donations can go to the Oseti Sakawan camp. There's a PayPal address, paypal.me/Oseti Sakawan camp, or they can go to P.O. Box 298, Cannonball, North Dakota, 58528. You can call or email your local congressman or representative. Call or email Dennis McDonough, the White House Chief of Staff. Jo Ellen Darcy, Assistant Secretary of the Army Corps of Engineers. Tell them to rescind the permits granted to the Dakota Access Pipeline Company. The Chief of Staff's email is dmcos@who.eop.gov. Phone number 202-456-3182. Okay. Jo Ellen Darcy, the Army Corps of Engineers Assistant Secretary, is Jo Ellen, JOELLEN .DARCY @usarmy.mil. Phone number 703-697-8986. You can call the Army Corps of Engineers office directly. Demand that they reverse the permits. 201-761-5902. Sign the petition to the White House, or as Tarnell said, send an email demanding that they stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. And again, you can donate. You can always look for local distribution points to donate supplies and cash to the camp. Also, check out Idle No More, a local collective that that has consistently come through with direct actions and protest actions in support of the Standing Rock Tribe. So thank you so much, Tano, for being here and for your words.
Thank you.
I'm going to give it back to Gerald and to our next guests.
My name.
Okay, we're back now. And I've got some good news for you. Real good news. For those of you who have heard about Brother Mumia Abdul-Jamal, the foremost political prisoner in America, innocent man, framed up for the murder of Daniel Faulkner in 1981 in Philadelphia, we now have a path to this brother's freedom. A new legal action filed by Mumia Abdul-Jamal in the Pennsylvania Court of Common Pleas on August 7, 2016, provides a path in the courts to overturn Mumia's conviction and win his freedom. Let me explain a little bit. There is a new decision by the Supreme Court called Williams versus the state of Pennsylvania. What this decision does is it says that no one, if you are convicted by a prosecutor, right, in court, that prosecutor cannot sit in the post-conviction relief appeals. In other words, they can't be the judge for your appeals also. In Mumia's case, we plan to go over this in detail. The judge that called the brother a nigger was his first appeal judge, Albert Sabo. I mean, you know, you gotta want, it's hard to even talk about this stuff, but now we have a chance. We have a chance to get Mumia out, and I'm doing what I can, and I'm hoping that you guys will pay attention to it. Listen, for those of you who have computers, you can read about this. Mumia's path to freedom is, it's now, we have a campaign going on. We want you to support this campaign. We have a demonstration plan Friday, December 9th. We're going to rally at Oscar Grant Plaza at 4 p.m. We're going to jump and shout, Black Liberation. Yeah, bruh, it's happening. So what we want you to do is to know that this is a very, very positive development. The Path to Mumia's Freedom by Rachel Walkerstein. If you Google it, it comes right up. You can read it for yourself. So while I certainly want my brother to develop many of the skills and the political depth of Mumia, we don't want no more Mumias. We don't want no more Mumias. We don't want nobody being framed up and put behind bars for crimes that they did not commit. So here in the studio right now, I have Brother Omar Shakir. Omar, first of all, why don't you just tell us a little bit what happened on the 24th? To my understanding, OPD, Oakland Police Detective Nadia Clark was in an accident in her car. Then what happened?
I was going to say thanks for having me, Brother Gerald, on your station. The night of July 23rd, that night, it was an accident and a shooting right after her accident. It was a raid that morning, the 23rd, at my residence. It was just caught by surprise. Like, I didn't know what was going on at that time. But me and my family woke up to flashbangs. They shot at the front door and the back door also. It was like troubling hearing that at my front back door. So they set off the flashbangs. Me and my family woke up to that morning. My family was walking and running up and down the stairs throughout the house. I heard over the loudspeaker my name. I'm thinking to myself, am I dreaming right now? I don't know. Why are they calling my name over the loudspeaker? So it's like, they tell me to come outside, put my pants on. I come outside and had me walk backwards to the street. And I was cuffed. They cuffed me, took me down, placed me in a police car down the street at the end of my block for about 30 minutes, 40 minutes. Took me downtown, questioned me, interrogated me. It was just an awful situation. But before I went downtown, I noticed my niece and nephews come outside. I had tennis in the back. My brother was there. My niece and nephew came outside with no shoes. I noticed that, and that was another awkward situation in the moment. It was just uncalled for. I was interrogated for 3 hours, 4 hours. My sister was also on her way to work and got literally kidnapped. She had her duties for the day and she just got kidnapped. It was like, it was sad. It wasn't supposed to happen, but she missed work that day. They searched my residence, the whole house, emptied out the whole house, turned it upside down. It wasn't supposed to happen. None of that was supposed to happen. In my eyes, it's like, it linked me to the situation, which was not a thorough investigation on their behalf. It was just like we were just talking. It's just the establishments that they cause they have, it just don't be all the way 100. It don't be all the way true. So
look, just to give you a little background now, remember, this nation, according to our so-called leadership, this started under Bush, is in a war against terrorism. But in reality, you can't be in a war against an idea. That's just language flourish, literary flourish. In fact, a war is something that takes place between states. They treated this incident where this person fired this weapon at Sergeant Clark as a terrorist incident from the beginning. They tried to keep their cards close to their, as we are now getting information to try to read the police reports and figure out why did they come to Omar's house at all. They try to keep it a secret. Why? It's terrorism. No, it's not. It's incompetence and foolishness. Do you want the army showing up at your door? This is what happened. We have the video. And we're going to make it. By the way, if you go to the Oscar Grant website, the information and police terror in Oakland is posted. You can read this for yourself. Now, to be really clear, you know, Omar's a little modest, okay? Because it's hard. You can't look at a person and see the inner strength. They mistreated this brother. They put him in solitary with no mattress. How many days?
3 days.
Come on now. Listen here. There is no Al-Qaeda operation here. This is police incompetence. It was the wrong house. They put that robot in the house, terrified those children. Right now, we have the good fortune to at least have some counseling for these kids. According to Fahima, the children don't even want to sleep in their own bed anymore. They're afraid. When the incident occurred, the children were running up and down the stairs. It was confusion, mayhem. When you see the video, you see one of the snipers set up outside. They had another sniper on the house next door when they tore the fence down to mount the sniper. There is something. We do not have to accept this treatment. We can do something about this. But right now we have a mission. This brother is innocent of all charges. He's done nothing. When we got the documents from the police, it said they designated Omar as suspect number one. That is, they thought he had fired the weapon. The Thursday following this incident, they arrested the person that they actually think fired the weapon in Stockton. They have yet to drop the charges on Omar. I want you to think about this. So we have a very simple plan. Step one, we want the charges dropped on Omar immediately and unconditionally. We're going to go to court. Omar, would you share your appeal to the public right now with us?
Let me just tell you a little about myself, Brother Jura. And whoever listening out there, my name is Omar Shakir. I was born on July 23rd, 1984, to a proud mother, a strong mother. I have brothers, a few sisters. Most of my life I've been interested in helping people around the world and bettering the world, like positive environments. That's what my people is based of, so that's what I grew up under. I grew up martial arts. I graduated from Oakland High School. I played football. I was into sports a lot. I did martial arts. I love African dance, drumming. I attended a little college, but I have a beautiful daughter overall. So blessed that I'm healthy, could do things like this, stand up for what's right, and basically, I just want to tell people I got court November 30th, Fallon Street, 1225 Fallon Street, November 30th, 8:30 a.m.
That is Department 11. We are not giving you this information because we think it's cute. Your support matters. What they do is they mug us in the dark like the low-life thieves that they are. When we show them that we have public support for this family, it will help to serve the struggle to make these bastards back off, because that's what they need to do. Let's be clear. This brother has committed no crime. This is from July, and they have still not dropped the charges. Once again, 1225 Fallon Street, Oakland, California, Department 11. We will be there. We're going to have our little colors, our T-shirts and stuff. We're going to have some buttons, hopefully. November 30th, 8:30 a.m. Please be there. Anything you want to say?
Yeah, I just want to say support system is always strong. It's always a positive thing. And I'm just try to end the year off strong. It's been a real tough year, man. So I just want to say stay positive, keep your head up, stay prayed up, and the struggle continues every day. Every day. It's a beautiful struggle. But overall, about my situation, support is good, and that situation never happened. It was totally wrong. I disturbed my peace and my family with that. It happens every day, and it's out of control. It just needs to stop. Thank you.
And thank you, brother. So there you have it. Drop the charges that have been leveled against Omar Shakir. We demand that the state immediately drop and unconditionally drop these charges. Remember, it could be you. One out of four of these assaults on people's homes is the wrong address in the United States. Why? It is an act of terror. Terrorize one, you terrorize millions. Don't accept it. Step up. Join us in court. Thank you very much.